Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, announced its vision for a 10-year, $20 billion broadband upgrade for the United States. It's saying it's time to move for the kind of internet access, fast, cheap, and available everywhere, that embraces the whole country, creates jobs, keeps the economy humming, and keeps America competitive. At the moment, we're behind. American access is slow, incomplete, and costly. This hour, On Point, playing catch-up on internet bandwidth and why it matters. You can join the conversation, how much is enough when it comes to bandwidth? Do you have it? Can you feel the U.S. lagging? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear about the growing push by cash-strapped states to tax online shoppers. But first, bandwidth. Joining me from Washington is Cecilia Kang, reporter for The Washington Post. She covers tech policy and writes the blog Post Tech. She's been covering the new FCC broadband initiative. Cecilia, great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
So, first of all, the problem. I'm reading that in South Korea, they already have 100 megabit per second connections to nearly all of the population. What's the situation in the U.S., Cecilia?
That's right. We are far behind. The rest of the world, the whole world, has really embraced the idea that the internet is going to be more integral and centered to all of our lives, our economy, our daily lives as people. And we are behind in that 35% of the population is not connected to high-speed internet. 5% of the population does not even have access. That's 100 million people who do not have broadband access at this point, or choosing not to adopt. What that means, really, and South Korea is a good example of a country that's ahead, so are many countries in Europe. To be fair, those countries are very densely populated, and so it's easier, for example, to get super fast fiber connections.
No great plains or Rocky Mountains in South Korea, and yet it's difficult terrain. They got mountains all over.
That's right. That's right. And we have a very big country geographically, mm-hmm. with some areas that are sparsely connected. And it's been a vexing problem for a long time. You know, it goes back even to the phone era. You know, it's been difficult to even get phone service out to the Great Plains, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing in the internet age is taking that whole, the idea that this is a public service, this is a public right to have for phone service in that era. Today, it's internet service. And we're bringing that, the FCC is attempting to bring that notion of connection to the high-speed internet going forward with some pretty big targets. Some would actually say that some of the targets aren't ambitious enough, but it is a game of catch-up. We're in some rankings about 16th in terms of speed.
I mean, I'm reading here in your own story, Cecilia, South Korea's got 100 megabits per second connection.
Yes.
The U.S. average connection is 3 to 4 megabits per second? I mean, that sounds like absolutely turtle pace compared to 100.
It is turtle pace. And I'll give you a real-world example. At 100 megabits a second, you can download a video, no problem. You can see, and this is important for not just for entertainment, but imagine if you're in a rural area of the United States and you want to transfer an X-ray to a doctor in New York.
Okay.
It takes a long time. It's very difficult to. If you have dial-up, it's nearly impossible. But if you want to do that with 100 megabits a second, that's possible. You can even have a real-time conversation over video on the web with that doctor in New York from the rural plains of the Great Plains.
But this isn't just about watching movies or playing online games. I mean, as you say, this is kind of the new base for the 21st century economy.
That's right, Tom. That's the way that the FCC, the administration, sees broadband. They see broadband really as the foundation, really the infrastructure of the economy going forward, and not just economy, the society. And the really vexing question and the problem to solve is, how can we do that without leaving some people behind? How can we accomplish some of these broadband goals without leaving those folks, either the urban poor, the people in rural areas where it's very difficult to deploy broadband, keep them in the conversation and keep them moving ahead, as the U.S. has determined that technology, innovation, competition in the high-tech world is going to be a bigger part of of our economy.
So there's access, there's speed. That's a problem for a lot of people, rural or poor or not. And then there's cost. American costs are high. How's the FCC proposing to address these? They want us to, what, be up to that South Korean speed of 100 megabits per second by 2020. I mean, that's 10 years from now. But even so, it's a big jump. How are they proposing we do it?
So they're proposing to do it. They're proposing to do it through several different, like dozens of recommendations. The way they're going to fund this is through retooling a big phone service fund called the Universal Service Fund. It's $8 billion a year. It's still being used to deploy and to operate regular old phone service to rural areas, to all kinds of areas that are hard to reach. They want to include broadband into that fund so that that fund can be tapped for the deployment and the building and the operation of new broadband networks. That's one way they're going to do this. The other thing is that they realize that the bigger part of the equation going forward is going to be mobile. And what that means is all those smartphones, the tablets, the iPad, all these unimagined devices that we don't know of today but that will exist in a couple years even, they want this to be a part of wireless technology, to be part of the broadband solution.
Because those are very bandwidth hungry. I mean, an iPhone wants a lot of service to bring down all of its wonderful features.
Exactly. And bandwidth is airwave spectrum is the oxygen of wireless networks. And in order to supply more oxygen, if you will, to wireless, the FCC is proposing taking over-the-air airwaves from broadcasters, as well as using other unlicensed type of airwaves, like what's known as white space, wireless, unlicensed Wi-Fi connections, and building a stronger base for wireless connectivity. So they want to take 500 megahertz of spectrum and use it, auction it for commercial carriers, so the AT&T's, Verizon's, the T-Mobile's, the Cellular South's of the world, to build their networks and have more robust networks going forward, because people are only going to go onto wireless networks more rapidly and use more of that bandwidth. So we see down the road that there's a shortage of airwaves for wireless, and the FCC is addressing this through some pretty specific proposals. Some people say it may not be enough, even that 500 megahertz may not even be enough.
They're going to take that from TV and radio? Are they fighting that? Is it going to crowd into my space here, Cecilia?
Well, hopefully. A lot of this, the airwaves that are being used from broadcasters and radio are not actually, that are in possession, I should say, of broadcasters, are not being used right now. But broadcasters want to be able to use some of those airwaves for the future. So there is definitely going to be a fight, Tom. And you're seeing already broadcasters saying that, you know, we're struggling as is. We want to be able to step up with our own new business models going forward. And so don't take FCC our only chance at the future, which is some of these airwaves.
Cecilia Kang with The Washington Post writes the blog Post Tech there. Cecilia, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you.
I want to go to Tim Wu. He's a professor of law at Columbia University. His piece, Bandwidth is the New Black Gold, was in the Time magazine recently. He joins us today from Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Tim Wu, lucky you. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
So do you see a solution to our sluggish internet connections coming here or not?
It is going to be an uphill battle. It's something that really hasn't changed as much as people thought. 10 years ago, the FCC is saying 10 years ago, 10 years from now, 10 years ago, everyone thought we would have solved all these problems a million times over. So it's a challenge.
What is it about our system, as opposed to France or South Korea or you name it, that has us, way down at a tenth or a 20th of their speed? What is it about the way we put our, broadband connections together that's held us back in speed and access?
Right. I think it's a number of factors, one of which is sort of not geographic. It's a very spread out country, as everyone points out. The other is that we have. I think actually the biggest factor, really though, is that we've relied completely on the private sector. There's been a faith that the private sector can solve all the problems over the last decade, and other countries have invested a lot more money, the way you might invest money in roads or other public infrastructure, have just invested to build things up a lot faster. The other things that other countries have done is they've actually been more interested in competition than we have. America basically has two companies that are fighting. Most countries set it up, Japan, France, all these countries, set it up so that multiple companies compete over the same wire. And that forces everyone to move to higher bandwidths. We haven't done that. It's called open access.
And we don't have open access. If I own the wire, I don't have to let you use it at all.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, there's not a lot of incentive for your average cable company or your average telephone company to really deliver a lot of bandwidth. I mean, one problem is if there's too much bandwidth, then maybe you'll stop watching TV because you can get all the shows on the Internet, or mm-hmm. maybe you'll stop using your phone service. So there's a really mixed, there's a serious conflict of interest within the industry as to how much it wants to deploy. The last 10 years, the policy has been the market can solve every problem, but it hasn't actually worked out that way.
Not the least, it might be if there's a lot more bandwidth, I might not be able to charge as much for it if I'm a cable company or a provider. I mean, they charge a lot in this country now.
Yeah, that's true. There's a, you know, it's a classic supply-demand situation, and as we learned from, you know, OPEC in the 70s, if you restrict supply, you can sometimes increase prices. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons that make the private industry have mixed feelings about this. You know, they are mixed. Verizon is kind of a leader in letting, to give them some credit, they have rolled out more fiber than other, a lot of other companies. But generally speaking, every reason to be slow. It's like the old AT&T monopoly. There was a lot of reasons for them just to do things very slowly because, you know, it was just, there's just two, there's only two companies offering broadband, and so why really, why go crazy?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's internet bandwidth problem and what we're going to do about it, how bandwidth becomes an economic choke point if you're not careful, and maybe we're at that point right now. Tim Wu is with us. He's a professor of law at Columbia University. Has written and thought a lot about bandwidth in this country, and judging by the number of callers we're getting, you're not alone in that, Tim. We're going to be joined in just a moment by Robert Atkinson, but let me get some callers in here right away. Nick in Shenandoah Valley, Virginia. Nick, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm a Washington, D.C. transplant, and I live in the Shenandoah Valley. I have a small farm.
Sounds
and,
great.
We operate a CSA in D.C., so we come in to deliver. But we have dial-up internet, and I've been trying for at least a year to get high speed, and I've been told by Verizon, Comcast, other folks, it's going to be 5 years before we get high speed. So I can't upload any websites. I can't upload just about anything.
So you're a farmer in the Shenandoah Valley. You got a CSA. So you sell or you provide produce to the Washington area. The internet connection would seem like a perfect way to organize that.
Exactly, and we're really hamstrung by our inability to operate out here in the rural area. We've set up a business. We're trying to provide jobs for the local economy, but you know, Comcast, Verizon have said we're not going to run the lines for maybe 5 years. I've even tried my cell phone. Apparently you can get a little device which will enable your cell phone to pick up the internet high speed, but it's so spotty out here that even with the cell phone plan it wouldn't work. So
community-supported agriculture, trying to get a better lock on the web there and more so. So there's an economic implication right there. Nick, let us hold that, and thanks for that. Courtney in Fletcher, Vermont. Courtney, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a lot of the same concerns as your previous caller, but as a mom and a teacher, I worry a lot about this generation of kids, both my students and my own kids, who I think with the limited access, we can't get internet, high-speed internet at our house and in a lot of the rural community where I live. And I worry about how they're going to compete when they haven't grown up with the same things that a lot of kids who live in more urban areas have. They don't have the access to the internet or the computer programs that, or even some of the other technology that other students and other children have.
It's a lot harder to use when it's coming at a kind of a trickle speed. Absolutely. Anybody who doesn't have broadband knows that. Courtney, thanks for your call. Get one more here. Burke County, Georgia. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering, I'd really like the FCC to answer this. When AT&T merged with Bell South, one of the requirements of the FCC, and AT&T agreed to it, was to give 100% of Bell South's former customers broadband internet by the end of 2007. So far, I cannot get the FCC to answer what the status is. And right now, I'm in my backyard. I can see the cooling towers of Plant Vogtle nuclear reactor. And if an emergency happens, we have 1940s technology on sirens to let us know.
And do you have broadband at this point, Rick, or still waiting?
No. We cannot load. Most websites can't load because they're built to 2010 standards.
Wow.
We have 1994 dial-up here that doesn't work. Most cell phones will not even work in the area.
That's got to be frustrating, and Americans are keenly aware of this. This is no secret at this point. Tim Wu is with us in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and right now from Washington, we're joined as well by Robert Rob Atkinson, founder and president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, formerly a VP at the Progressive Policy Institute, author of The Past and Future of America's Economy. Rob Atkinson, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
You heard right there our economic complaint from our farmer in Virginia, our education complaint from our teacher and mom in Vermont, and then in Georgia, they're drumming their fingers and waiting on what they thought was a promise of broadband. People are really keenly aware of this, Rob.
Well, sure, because what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years is broadband has become something that you could have or choose not to have to something that you really we have to have. Everybody really needs to have broadband to succeed, to be able to educate their kids, to engage in commerce. But I think in a lot of ways, we have to look at what other countries did and draw the right lessons. You know, why would we expect a private provider to provide broadband to some of these rural areas when the most they can hope to recover is perhaps a third or even half of their costs? That's why we have government to make up the difference. And if we look at what other countries did, you mentioned Korea or Japan. The reason Korea and Japan have 100% or close to 100% broadband penetration is because they subsidized it. And what they did is they gave direct grants as well as tax incentives to the telephone companies to say, you go out and deploy this. We know it's going to be pretty expensive. Mm-hmm. We know that you can't make up the difference just by what you're going to get from the subscribers. So we're going to help you. That's what we haven't done in this country, and that's the major reason we don't have as much broadband in rural areas, not because our companies are any more or less looking to make profits as NTT or Korea Telecom or in Sweden or in other countries. Mm-hmm. And this is why the FCC plan is so important, because now for the first time we provide a systemic and ongoing subsidy so that they can put broadband in areas where it's pretty expensive to put it otherwise.
Tim Wu, are you confident that this plan will do it if Congress picks it up and runs with it? This $8 billion a year, as I heard Cecilia's report, that they would apply to it. Is that enough to...
I doubt it, to be honest. It's not a bad start. I doubt it's going to solve some of the problems we heard the callers talking about. You know, there's a long history of this kind of thing. Electricity, America had the same kind of problems. For decades, people in rural areas wouldn't get electricity. It's not a bad start. I mean, I favor it. What the FCC is also doing is taking a really big bet on wireless, that wireless will solve the problems. And I hope that works out, but it is a big bet. It's not clear whether all the things they're going to do with wireless will solve the problems that the callers are talking about.
So is most, Rob, is most of the new bandwidth that they hope to bring on stream going to be, you know, wire or fiber optic or wireless, just in the air?
Well, it's going to be both. I think what's important to recognize is that we're relatively quickly going to be transitioning to what is called 4G. So right now, a lot of services are at what's called 3G. 4G is going to provide, another word for it is LTE, long-term evolution. It's going to provide much faster wireless speeds, something in the range of 8 megabits a second, which is, as you noted, faster than what the average speed is. So I actually think, and if you look at what the FCC plan does, it actually, for the first time, will provide subsidies to get wireless into rural areas, cell towers and cabling to the cell towers. So I think that's going to be an important step. I just have to go back, though, and comment a little bit on, you know, if we want to know why we're behind and why other countries are ahead, it's really important to look at, I think, some of the key factors. Are one of the main reasons you see higher speeds in other countries, you mentioned France, for example, is what's called a loop length. In other words, the how long the copper wire is, the phone wire that the DSL runs on from the person's home to what's called the central office. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has the longest loop lengths in the world. France has some of the shortest. So
because we're such a big country, or we just
Because France and a lot of the French cities, even small towns in France, they're relatively concentrated, and so you don't have this kind of suburban dispersal that we have. When you have suburban homes, I live in Washington, mm-hmm. but I live in the inner suburbs. You're going to hook up 10,000 homes to one central office. You're going to have long pieces of wire that go do that. In France, you can do 10,000 homes and have short pieces. pieces of wire. Well, the way that technology works, if you're on a short piece of wire, you can get speeds 3 to 4 times faster than on a long piece of wire without doing anything different. You just that's what the wires allow. So we have to recognize that, that's part of what the benefit, the advantage that some of these European and Asian countries have. They just aren't as suburban. One last factoid on that, which I think a lot of people don't know. We actually have more fiber optic cable than, per capita than Europe does. We have less than Japan and Korea, but we have more than Europe. And that's pretty good because we are a suburban country largely, and that's hard to do that in the suburbs.
Tim, I hear you there.
Yeah, I want to jump in. I mean, I agree with that, and I think that it's right. The physical stuff is important. But there is also the fact that the industry here hasn't been that interested in the Internet. You know, the cable and telephone companies are not fundamentally that interest in selling high internet speeds because they just haven't seen. I mean, they're doing a little bit of it, but they face no real competition other than each other. So I agree, it's a mixture of physical factors, but the industry structure always makes a difference. And when you have people sort of pushing, I mean, let's give an example on the cable coax cables. Now you could offer a lot faster internet speeds. You'd have to lose some of the cable channels that people aren't watching. It's not their business model, but you could over the existing cable plan have much faster cable internet speeds. People are always talking about these things, but they don't really ever seem to happen. I just want to put that in.
And why would that be in this country as opposed to others? You know, why would companies here not be interested in higher speed? Consumers would surely be very happy to have it.
Tom, can I respond to that
first, please,
though? Because I think it's important. If you read the FCC plan, there's a page in there that talks about what's going on with speeds in the U.S. and deployment plans. And what you see is in the cable, we get broadband really two main ways, over the telephone wires or fiber by the telephone companies and cable. In cable, there's a new technology that's really only been sort of starting to be deployed in the last year and developed called DOCSIS 3. Probably 5 to 10 times faster cable speeds than what we have today. Virtually every single cable company now in the U.S. is beginning to deploy that this year. We see in terms of Verizon deploying fiber to the home, AT&T deploying fiber to the node, Quest deploying fiber to the node. So this is happening, and I think it's not quite right to say that they have no interest in doing that. There is a lot of competition out there to be able to get to that next generation, and we're actually ahead of the world when it comes to deploying DOCSIS 3.
Let's get to Michigan, Cadillac, Michigan, and Rick. Rick, you are on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
During the Clinton administration, early on, the communications companies all received big tax breaks and ratepayer subsidies in the billions of dollars, and they were supposed to guarantee that people were connected to high broadband,
yep.
Got these broadband connections, which they never did. And in addition to that, during that same period, I live in a rural area up here in Michigan.
Uh-huh.
They ran fiber optic for miles and miles by all these houses, put taps to the houses, installed the taps,
mm-hmm.
up not clear to the house, but up into the yard where they could tap into the line.
Right.
Not one bit of result came out of that, other than a little scar in the ground for a while.
That's hard to understand. So the fiber optic's right there, and you don't have access to it, Rick?
No, nobody up here's got access to any of that stuff.
Boy, you can hear in every single call, Tim, the frustration. People want this, and there it's right in the front yard, and they can't get it. Were there subsidies that had requirements that were not met? And can you imagine why somebody would run a fiber optic line through, all my neighbors' yards and not let me tap it?
Yeah, I just don't think that it. I think companies are used to a certain type of business model, and I repeat what I said before, mm-hmm. that I don't think the telephone companies and the cable companies have been fundamentally that interested in the internet. Now Robert said that they're starting to change a little bit and starting to roll stuff out, but they've done the minimum to sort of collect subsidies and so forth, but they just haven't been that interested. They're used to making money off phone service, and used to making money off television, and their company's doing something that's not their usual way, and they're sort of afraid that the internet will take away. They just don't know how to make money off the internet, and they're nervous because companies like Google seem to be making all the money, not them. So,
but isn't phone service or voice communication going to the internet, Tim?
Well, it is, but it's going to wireless.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually it's going to wireless, which the telephone companies love because they make lots of money. There's hundreds of billions of dollars at stake here in old business models. And when there's hundreds of billions of dollars, there's hundreds of billions of reasons not to put any kind of threat to them. And the Internet generally is a threat to existing business models. I mean, it's a threat to every business model, even the people who provide it, which is what's strange. They're all conflicted. They all have conflicted interests. Now, I'm not saying they haven't done anything, but I'm saying that a really fast Internet would strike at some of the foundations of their revenue, and that's always been a little bit of an issue for them.
Maybe they want you to have it, and maybe they don't. Let's get a call from Marshfield, Vermont. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I have a bit of a different situation than the rest of the callers. I'm a computer programmer. I've had broadband Internet connections in various different places in Vermont and broadband wireless. I started with the 2.5G, the Edge connection, which was available from Unicell, which has now become AT&T,
okay,
back in 2005. I hit the upper limit of the cable modem every day. And when I use the wireless devices, I have a modem built into my computer, my laptop, and I also have a 3.5 or a 3G cell phone with the HSDPA, and I hit the upper limit of that every day.
So what does that mean for you in practical terms, Jeff? Does it slow down your work? Does it bring you to a halt? What?
It does slow down my work. I mean, I find that I'm waiting on the Internet connection rather than if it had, you know, done what I asked it to and done it instantaneously, I would be more productive and it would be better. I'd be able to serve my clients better and just be better all the way around.
Yeah, no doubt. Jeff, thanks for your call. Rob Atkinson, multiply that times millions of Americans and you've got a drag on the economy.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, this is, I think, again, we have to look at really what other countries did, though. Other countries are willing to put large amounts of money behind this. Sweden, for example, 10 years ago, invested about the equivalent of $30 billion, largely through tax breaks and some grants for their existing companies to deploy faster networks. The last caller I'm quite sympathetic with, but in some ways the last caller is sort of asking us to change the laws of physics. One of the reasons why wireless has constraints today is for a couple of reasons. One is too many cities and towns won't let companies deploy cell towers. You just can't do this if you don't deploy cell towers. You need better spectrum, and that's what the FCC plan is doing. And then just to go back to the point about Tim's point about that somehow these companies aren't invested in this, today companies invest about $60 billion a year in broadband. I don't know what more Tim wants to see out of this. That's an awful lot of money. And they're continuing to invest and upgrade their networks. One of the key things we have to recognize, just look in where I live, along the East Coast in Washington, Verizon provides 20 megabits to the home, fiber optic connection, and they provide 5 megabits also. The vast majority of Verizon subscribers buy the 5 megabits because they don't see a big need to go to the 20. If people were demanding the higher speeds and willing to pay a little bit more for them, we'd see more of that. So I think in a lot of ways where we are is this chicken or egg issue. One of the key things I think in the broadband plan is that all of the work they're talking about of health IT, better applications for e-government, education, that's going to also give people a reason to want higher speeds. That's part of the problem we have here as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's bandwidth problem and what the country's going to do about it. The FCC's got a big proposal to get up to 100 megabits per second by the year 2020. South Korea's there now. We're down around 3 or 4 on average. That's way behind the lead. Tim Wu is with us. He's a professor of law at Columbia University, joining us today from Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Robert Atkinson is here from Washington. He's president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. They're author of The Past and Future of America's Economy. George in Bowling Green, Kentucky. You're on the air, George.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
A long, long time ago, I remember conversations that mentioned information as being the fourth utility, along with gas and electric and telephone.
Right.
If ever there was a time when information is the fourth utility, it is today.
Yes, sir.
It concerns me that urban electrical providers who have the infrastructure in cities don't see their infrastructure as a base around which to put connected Internet. And the rural electrical providers who have infrastructure out in the communities don't see themselves as being the provider.
Do you mean doubling up on power lines, George, or what do you mean exactly?
Sure. There's a thing called broadband over power lines. that's been around 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a technology probably in search of an implementation, and I'm just curious about why that doesn't see larger implementation and why electrical utilities in urban and suburban areas don't see themselves as providers as well as phone companies and cable companies.
Let us pick it up, George. Tim, first to you. What about that path as an avenue for a broadband expansion?
Well, first of all, I want to agree with the caller that I regard Internet access as a utility, and I think it's really important to understand it that way. You know, it's as important as electricity, and it would be absurd with some of these callers if we said, well, you know, for some reason they won't give us electric service. You know, we'd say, well, unless you're in the very top of the Colorado Mountains, that would be crazy.
Or if they gave you water, but only a trickle.
Yeah, or a trickle. I think it is really important to conceptualize this as a utility. And a lot of countries, as Robert pointed out, do conceptualize it as a utility, understand it's important to the economy, and have invested heavily in it. And we have this sort of idea that it's still kind of a luxury or something for fun. Or, you know, and you know, look, the Internet's fun, but it's also a business necessity. So I want to agree with that. Broadband over power line has been around. It's one of these things that's been around for a very long time, but has never quite panned out, and no one knows why. There's a lot of kind of things that people are always hoping are going to solve all the problems but don't really end up working, and broadband over power line is one of those. I don't know why. I mean, there was a New York Times. There's always a story somewhere about how some mm-hmm. town has broadband over power line, and it's, you know, these high speeds, but it doesn't seem to have really panned out, and I don't really understand why.
Rob, do you know?
Well, I don't think the technology is quite good enough, and the second reason is, which I think, frankly, a lot of people misunderstand what's going on in this debate. If you think about putting a line to somebody's home, that's an incredibly capital-intensive investment. So, for example, how many sewer lines do we have to our home? We have one. How many electric lines? We have one. We're lucky in this country that we actually have two. We have the cable line and the phone line that both, because of technology reasons, were able to be upgraded. If we think that the way to go forward is to get even more lines coming into the home, what we're all the only thing we're going to do with that is we're going to raise total costs. So somebody's going to have to build another line. They're going to have to get money for it.
The other line you're talking about would be if indeed we piggybacked on the electrical utilities, for example.
Or there are a lot of people out there who think that government money should go to supporting a third line that's government-owned. Now, if you do that, all you're going to do is raise overall costs because society has to build another line, whether it's power lines or government-owned or other things. And secondly, what you'll do is you'll reduce revenue for existing companies. And let me just finish, Tim, real quick.
Sure.
Let me just finish. If you do that, I mean, by definition, you have to because you have a certain amount of people in the marketplace who have revenue. And if you're adding another competitor
obviously. So,
yeah. So by the way, one of the things the Japanese did, and they recognize this, when the Japanese got NTT, their major provider, to deploy fiber to the home to 90% of the population, they said, you don't have to unbundle that to competitors. You can just sell that directly. It's your fiber. And the reason they did that is because they wanted to give them an incentive to do that. So we need to be thinking about how do we get incentives for them to do this.
Government-owned lines, Tim, is there an interest in that?
I don't think that many people are interested. What Robert just pointed out is the word natural monopoly, and he's exactly right. This is a natural monopoly. You know, that there's not a lot of... We are lucky to have two lines, but generally it's a natural monopoly or duopoly, which is exactly what creates all these problems. I don't think there's that much support for... I think it's a bit of a red herring. I don't think there's that many people who are saying government should go out and build lines like a version of the public option or something.
Aren't we paying substantially more than a lot of other countries for our broadband access already, Tim?
Sorry?
Aren't we paying more in this country very often?
Yes, we are. Yes, we generally are. That's true.
Now, why is that? Because there's only a couple of options for most people?
Well, it's because it's a natural... Well, it's because there's a natural duopoly, and because other countries have forced line sharing, which has forced the prices lower. Because if competitors are using, you know, if you have 10 companies over the same line, now not 10 different lines, but 10 companies over a single line, they'll tend to drive prices a little lower.
The reality is, if the assumption that in that argument that line sharing drives costs lower is it has to be that somehow profits are too high. Otherwise, where would the savings come from competition? And if you look at the profits of companies in the broadband space, we did a little model. You cut the profits in half and see what you get. What you get is a dollar a month cost reduction. And the reason you do that is that profits are not the reason, excess profits are not the reason costs are high. It's just real costly to do broadband in the United States. Much cheaper to do it in France, where you can put fiber optic cable in Paris in the sewer system for free, and that's pretty cheap.
Why should Americans on the eastern seaboard or in California, where populations are pretty dense, why should they pay more than some of these other countries we're talking about? Isn't that a drag on the economy, Rob?
Well, they pay more because it costs more.
In New York City? In Washington? In Dallas?
Well, if you think about Verizon, for example, how they have to price their plan, do we really want Verizon to be pricing their service lower in a high-dense area? And because think about what that means for a minute. That means they're going to, by definition, have to charge higher prices in low-density areas. And I don't think we want that as a society. So what they do is they make a little bit more money in New York City, let's say, or Washington, D.C., and they lose a little bit of money out in the outer suburbs. I think that's actually good for society. So that, look, when you really look at the densities in the U.S., they are much, much lower than in Paris or Stockholm or Tokyo or Seoul. Mm. And that's a big reason why we simply pay more, because it costs more.
I want to come back to the point that I don't think these companies are that interested in internet broadband. No, they're interested in what they love, actually, is wireless services, because the amount of money you can make on wireless broadband, charging for data plans when people run over, and you make a killing over there. And I just don't think they're fundamentally that interested. Verizon has been better. AT&T, I don't think, is fundamentally that interested. And they said they're indifferent to it. They set the price of whatever they like to. These are huge companies, and so it's really hard to just, what Rob does, is take out one little thing, broadband services. They have all kinds of ways, and they focus their efforts on what makes the most money right now, and what makes the most money is wireless.
Tim, will wireless bail us out then on broadband eventually, nationally or not?
What I worry about with wireless is that, it could, but first of all, what we're relying completely on the private sector, and it's extremely... The spectrum policy, as Cecilia discussed, is basically a disaster in this country. Everyone agrees on that. And so, I don't know. It's a dangerous bet. We are right now betting, the broadband is heavily betting on wireless. And even if it does succeed, we'll have what you have, which is the wireless internet is a little different than the wire internet. It tends to be more expensive and tends to have certain services not allowed and so forth. I don't know. It's a risky bet. That's what I'm going to say.
And spectrum, that is what radio bandwidth and how it gets allotted. Do you see in the FCC plan a lot of that being moved and coming on stream enough to change these numbers so that we don't look like the super laggard on the international charts?
I mean, I think the FCC is brave. They are definitely going for it in their broadband plan. They're going for they're doing more in wireless than they are in other areas, in my opinion. And so, I commend them for that maneuver. They're trying to free up as much spectrum as they can, but they have to act really aggressively. I'm more aggressively than they are right now if they really hope wireless is going to change things. Wireless has a tendency not to deliver to expectations. I mean, 5 years ago, everyone said that 3G was going to solve every wireless problem. 3G is here. It's a lot slower than it was promised. It just doesn't work as well as people hope. If you have an iPhone, it's always congested. So now everyone's saying, well, 4G is going to solve every problem. But when 4G comes along, I don't know. We've had a lot of disappointment in wireless before. So I'm giving kind of a mixed answer. I can understand why they're trying to make that bet. But as I say again, I think it takes more aggressive action in this area to really get what we need.
And if we succeed in getting to 100 megabits per second by 2020, where's the rest of the world going to be at that point, Tim?
Yeah, it could be.
South Korea's there today. I mean, are they still increasing speeds or are they topping out?
Sorry?
Are they still increasing speeds abroad, or is it like...
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, the target that people are looking at is what happens when you go to gigabit. People are interested in going to... no one's there on a reliable basis, but people, I think, are interested in going to much radically faster speeds because, really, fiber optics has nearly unlimited capacity. So I think, the 2020, 100 megabit, we may get there anyway without a broadband plan. A lot of people have pointed that out. And, yeah, I really think this needs to be taken a lot more seriously, treated as a national utility, and treated and pushed as far as we can push it.
Well, we've heard from plenty of Americans hungry for that change today. Tim Wu with Columbia University joining us from Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks. It's been great.
And Robert Atkinson in Washington, D.C. at the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
In a moment, cash-strapped states move to tax online purchases. This is On Point. An increasing number of states are trying to collect money any way they can, including on sales taxes from online purchases. New York is doing it now. Many other states are trying to follow in New York's footsteps. Jeffrey Fowler covers technology and e-commerce for the Wall Street Journal. He joins us from San Francisco. Jeffrey, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's going on? What's New York doing, and who wants to follow how?
So New York really sort of took the lead on this issue back in 2008. And it's an old issue. I mean, this is something that that we've been talking about ever since e-commerce was invented over a decade ago. But you know, the recession has really caused a lot of states to try to figure out some new ways to bring in extra revenue, and one of them is charging people for sales tax for their online purchases. So the way that New York did this is they found an interesting way to prove that online retailers like Amazon.com actually have people on the ground in the state. And if you have people on the ground in the state, that means you have to collect sales tax there.
So who does Amazon have? I thought they were all out in a warehouse in Seattle or something.
Well, yes, that's what Amazon claims. But what New York did is they made a law that redefined these people that are called marketing affiliates. And these are folks that maybe run a website or a blog that include links to e-commerce sites. Hmm. Every time people click on those links and buy something, those sites get a little money back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Amazon and other e-commerce sites call those folks advertising channels, just like you might call, say, the Wall Street Journal. But the state of New York and now increasing number of other states say, no, they're actually sales agents, and they're people on the ground. And if you have that many people on the ground, you have to collect sales tax.
So do they do it automatically? How does New York do it? I mean, I do it, you know, I buy a book from Amazon. How do they know? How do they collect?
Well, if you're getting it billed to or shipped to New York State, Amazon now just collects the money and turns it in to the state. Now, one of the arguments that Amazon has about this is that it's actually really cumbersome and difficult to know in every state and every city how much tax to charge, and that's really a difficult thing for them to be able to do.
How much potential revenue are we talking about here?
Well, there was a study that was done last year by the University of Tennessee, and it said that, you know, if all of the states were collecting the sales tax, which they're already owed, I mean, let's be clear on this, these aren't new taxes, these are things that we were already supposed to be paying, around the country, that they could bring in $11 billion a year by 2012.
That's a big deal. Already owed, you're saying, I'm not even sure how this works. I should probably know, this may indicate I haven't paid my state the sales tax, but already owed, why, how?
Well, there's a line on most people's income tax statements that says use tax. Now, use tax is tax you're supposed to pay on things that you bought out of state. So technically, we're all supposed to be filling in, you know, the books and the Kindles that we bought on Amazon.
Oh, of course. I knew that. Of course I did that, yeah.
Of course, yeah, of course you do.
I see. I got it. So who's thinking about getting more aggressive on this front? What does it mean to go from the thing that's already there to something more aggressive?
Right. So New York State did this first, right? And so they're basically forcing Amazon and other sites to collect for it. Now, that's being challenged in court, and there's a big suit over that in New York State. Meanwhile, North Carolina and Rhode Island copied New York's law and did something very similar. And New York's thinking about even getting – I'm sorry, North Carolina is thinking about getting even more aggressive about it and asking sites to for back taxes for previous years before they even passed their law. Now, I should note that North Carolina and Rhode Island, the way that Amazon and other big sites responded was by pulling out their deals with marketing affiliates in those states. So currently, if you live in North Carolina or Rhode Island, you do not pay sales tax on Amazon purchases because they pulled out of those affiliate relationships in the state. And then earlier this year, Colorado came in with its own law, which is a slightly different flavor. And instead of having the affiliate language, they said, you know, if you're an online merchant, you either have to collect the tax yourself or you have to turn in every year a list of all of the online purchases that people in the state made.
Mm-hmm.
So ostensibly, I guess they could go in and collect and demand that use tax themselves since they have a list of it all.
And you write that others are thinking about doing this. California,
yeah.
Connecticut, Illinois, Maryland, Virginia, Vermont. Is this going to be the law of the land in another few years?
Well, we're certainly heading that way. Now, one theory is that all these individual states coming up with their own laws isn't really a great way to go about this. And on a national level, Congress could take action. There's something called the Simplified and Streamlined Sales Tax Initiative, which about 23 states have joined. It's just a project to make it easier to know from place to place how much sales tax ought to be collected. Now, Congress could pass a law which would say in all those states that have agreed to this, it's a requirement for out-of-state merchants to collect the sales tax for those places. But so far, Congress hasn't taken action on that. It's been before them for a couple times now, and one theory is, of course, they don't want to look like they're putting any new taxes on us.
Jeffrey, we just got a couple of seconds. I saw record sales online reported late last year. Do e-commerce people think it's going to slow them down?
Well, that's a concern. I mean, it's one advantage that they have over the, you know, Main Street retailers is this, you know, 5 to 10%. So certainly they're going to fight this every bit that they can.
Jeffrey Fowler with The Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for joining us.
You bet.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.